Yes. So as Jerry said, I'm going to tell a story this morning about how one pumpkin fed 5 million people.
Wow.
It's indeed a lot. And actually, the head accounting person at USC helped me figure this out. Pumpkin. That is absolutely one way that this story could be told. But I've actually got a slightly different way that this happens. And it's something that you can think about with just about everything that you eat that comes from seeds. And I spend a lot of time thinking and working with seeds and people who spend time with seeds. So, yeah. So, I thought about it. There was actually a pumpkin at Robin's wonderful farm. Even at this time of year, there were some pumpkins on her farm stand, but I didn't grab one, so I have a lovely picture of a beautiful pumpkin. Just a nice standard-sized pumpkin that we might see more in October or September. So what are some of the types of things for a meal that you can make from a pumpkin?
Roasted pumpkin seeds.
What else can you? Pumpkin pie. Tio? You can make juice, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Porridge.
Muffins or bread. Soup, absolutely. Cheesecake. I make a really nice pumpkin curry. They grow pumpkins all over Asia, and I'm really used to using pumpkin in the curries that I make when I'm at my home in Ottawa. So there are a lot of things we could make from this pumpkin. The one thing we won't do, though, is we won't roast any of the pumpkin seeds. So we would have our one pumpkin in October, a nice day in October. And we cut open the pumpkin and put the seeds aside and cook. Maybe four people could have a nice little meal that night with some soup or curry, pumpkin muffins, and maybe some cheesecake as well. That's a good idea. And so four people have a meal. And then we wait through the winter, and there were about 300 seeds in that pumpkin. And we dry them out, leave them to stay someplace cool and dry, and the next fall plant 300 pumpkin plants. You've already figured out the story. So you plant 300 pumpkin plants. What if each plant had four pumpkins? So in October we plant those seeds, and then in May we would have 1,200 pumpkins to work with. That's a lot already. And we take those for a meal and save all the seeds and make muffins and soup and curry from all those and have a pretty decent meal for 4,800 people could have a meal. It's also a lot of dishes, which is something a young person pointed out to me. And I said, indeed, that is absolutely true. And we, from that meal in that second October, save all those seeds from the 1,200 pumpkins, plant those. Now we're talking serious acreage for the pumpkins now. Plant all of those in October, and come to in May and June and July, each one of those has a pumpkin. We are up to 360,000 pumpkins. And cut them all open and take out all the seeds and put them to the side, clean them off, dry them, eat all that wonderful pumpkin, share it with close to, I think, have that many plants, we'd have 1 million pumpkins at that point. And all of those people, four people, and the million plus a few extra, could have a meal. And all of that started with one pumpkin, with 300 seeds. From those pumpkins, it can keep going and going and going. Exactly. It's amazing that we are not covered in pumpkins at this very moment. Absolutely true. I was inspired in thinking about pumpkin and pumpkin math and this very generous single pumpkin and all the people that can eat from it by somebody who pointed out to me, it was a farmer friend who said, you know, vegetables are so generous to us. One kernel of corn planted in the ground and a stalk, maybe three cobs. Each cob might have 300 or 400 kernels on it. That's 1 to almost 1,000 possibly. And farmers, especially seed farmers, know some of those calculations, how much to count on in terms of the seed that they will have from particular crops. So really, they give back to us so very much that it's really important to remember how generous they are to us. And we can be generous back in the way we take care of the soil and the way we take care of seeds and the way we support farmers, particularly in farming communities. There's a couple friends here with some thoughts to share. Yes. That's true. Not every seed always ends up being a plant. Some of them do get eaten, like corn. We actually eat the seeds, so they don't get used. And some of them won't have matured enough to be able to grow. And watermelons are tiny here in Victoria. But there are some other things that I've seen here at the CD Saturdays and events I've been at that grow very well and very big. Because I'm from Ottawa, and right now, not many things are growing in Ottawa. Except for the icicles and the snowbanks, which I happen to really like anyway. And they're actually very good for our soil there to be frozen and under the snow for so many months of the year. It's actually very good for our soil to be cold. One more friend. Hi there. They're big ones in Mexico, that's right, because I think that's more where they came from originally. Huge ones. Well, I hope you will all maybe think of how generous pumpkins and squash and corn and so many plants are to by how many seeds they have in them. And enjoy your time here today, and I'll be around after the service. And there's lots of things on our websites for young people and the Sow and Save program and Name That Seed games and things like that. You sure are. And it's been very nice to meet you. I'll see you after the service as well.
We will now have a few minutes of meditation, personal reflection. As you draw in deep, nurturing breaths, contemplate these words by Kate Green, inspired from the Lakehead Unitarian Congregation. As you draw in deep, nurturing breaths, feel into your own gratitude for seeds. For generous seeds like maize, which from ancient roots gives back 1,000-fold for each kernel. For feisty seeds that need to be frozen or scratched or soaked and cajoled into releasing the very first shoot. For indestructible seeds which have lasted and laid in wait for hundreds of years only to be rediscovered. For beautiful bean seeds that show off their rainbow of colors, stripes, spots, and slashes from bean to pod to pot. For funny seeds that are uneven and bumpy, giving no clue as to what they might become. For plain seeds that are simple and round and solid, ready to produce the softest, tenderest lettuce leaf, dripping with morning dew. For light seeds that blow in the wind or drift upon the waters, spreading and sharing beyond gardens, fields, and continents. For seeds sown into hems, braided into hair, and carried along life's most perilous of journeys to unknown lands. For the complexity of seeds and the knowledge they keep inside and share only when people pause and watch. For the bounty of seeds that are quick to sprout and grow, the wind too soon blows them away. May they forgive us our cultivation and fondly remember their roots. And finally, for seeds now gone, who fed us in their times that we might have life. For all these, we give thanks.
One of the things that I like the very most about speaking at Unitarian congregations across the country is that it's a time for me to be very personal about my work, and there can be nothing more personal than that lovely introduction and remembrance by Mel and the many years that we've known each other. In my position as a program manager, I have many, many different roles. In fact, there was a university researcher who wanted to study just what a program manager does at an international development agency. And it is unusual for us to be able to speak very personally about our work. So often we are focused on having things go very well, be responsive in the communities where we work, whether it's in Mali or Ethiopia or Nepal. In working with local government issues, sometimes with very difficult disasters or conflicts in community, writing reports, financial monitoring, audits, the 24-hour work cycle. It's now the workday morning in Dhaka. Or they've already finished one day of work, actually, today, because they work on Sundays. So it's very nice to pause and reflect and speak about our work this way. So thank you for having me. I'm missing, of course, my good friends Mike and Lisa, who are traveling. I often stay with them, and they often are lead the service when I've been here. But of course, with Robin and Mel and Christine, I saw Maya, and Faye is another friend, so I feel very welcome. And thank you very much from my friends and other runners at USC, for many of you supported or indeed ran in the Run for Biodiversity events last year or the year before. And that money is raised and matched threefold. The one here in Victoria does go directly to the Nepal program. And I do run in the R4B in Ottawa with my youngest daughter. So, and many of us in the staff and our families. But now we have many hundreds of people across the country in different runs and events for us. So thank you very much to this congregation in particular, and the young people I know were very involved in, Robin and Mike and Lisa and others. I hope most of you know a bit about USC, and Mel mentioned our founder. Though we've been around now, it will be 70 years next year. This year, 1945. It'll be 70 years, and the world has changed a lot in that time. Working in the Global South has changed. Canada has changed as well. But there are three very core values that Dr. Hitchmanova felt strongly about in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, 70s and into the 80s that we do continue, even though our work may look very different from those early days working in orphanages and with refugees. The first is our wonderful local colleagues. I don't believe we've ever actually had a Canadian as a country director or a lead of a program overseas. We've had individuals like Mel or a grad student, but it's always been local people, and she felt very strongly about that, and I cannot speak highly enough of my colleagues, Sisto in Timor, Hasnera in Bangladesh, Pratap, Bharat, the group in Nepal. All of them are extraordinary people, and we learn from them. Also, sustainability. Still, everything that we do, we plan to have a time when it will run itself or be fully embedded in the community. So the stoves, which are wonderful and one of my favorite things, especially for Humla, and they support agriculture and health in very important ways, no one in Humla could afford the cash cost of one of those stoves. But they last forever. They simply do not break. They're so well designed. They're locally made, actually, one plane flight away from Humla, so we have to fly them up. But they are completely sustainable when they're in place. Of the hundreds that we have helped put in place, I don't know of one that is not working every day. It's been years and years and years. So they sustain so easily. The seed work, our organic agriculture work, community water systems, all those things need to be made, set up from the beginning to be locally sustainable. And the other aspect she felt important, felt was important, was to know when to move on and to phase out. And so years ago we had programs in Indonesia, and those finished, and we began working in Bolivia, moving on to another country. And places where we've worked for many decades, we've moved from different parts of the country, up valleys, into the next district, things like that. So we're on the move slowly and carefully all the time. The vignettes that I'd like to share this morning and then tie together are all around seeds and seasons. And sometimes the seasons move very quickly. All of a sudden it will feel like it's winter again, or the sun will suddenly be warmer and spring has started to come. So working in the seasons can move quickly and also seem very, very slow and take forever to move to the next season. And working with seeds is so much like that. There are some processes in growing food and working with seeds that move very quickly. The germination, the first little shoot comes out, can be in a day or two. And in really warm days in Ottawa in the spring, you can watch the garden grow. 6 inches in a day will happen. I've watched that happen in Ottawa. And other times, it's unbelievably slow. A farmer overseas that we were working with as they were trying to have more seed available in their community, he said, you know, we're not going to know if we did a good job saving these seeds for this type of, it was a type of barley being grown high up in Humla. He said, we're not going to know for 2 years if we did a good job this year. Because a lot like the pumpkin story, they will save that seed and plant it, see how it does the next growing season, save seed again and plant it again. And then they'll really know if that variety and that work has gone well. It takes a long time to work with seeds. Indeed, it's taken thousands of years to have the wonderful bounty of diversity that we have today. There are three main program areas where we work in Nepal, and I'll tell a little story from each of the three, and I'll start high up in the mountains in Humla, which you do need to fly into or walk for 10 or 12 days. And in Humla, they have an extremely short growing season from May to end of September. And they really only have that one. And that's the food supply for the whole rest of the year, that along with livestock. And so having enough seeds, enough diversity of crops to grow is really important, because if something's different, you can't plant again. You might be able to plant a few weeks later, but you don't have a lot of leeway. You need to get seeds in, get things growing, and harvest them and dry them and get them inside before the snow comes. And up in Humla, one of the things that's very difficult is they don't have a lot of different varieties of barley and wheat, and they do grow some rice right next to the rivers. And so through connections in other high areas in Nepal, we've brought in very small, carefully selected varieties to try in very small. It's kind of like a book club, except for barley. And we also do it with beans and chilies and other. But they meet. They plant them in little plots, not much bigger than this lovely table, and make a sign. And they do it right by the trail, so everybody can see them. And they meet every week and talk about what's going on and look at them and really invest time. And they'll make notes if that's possible. And our colleagues connect with them and try and join the meeting every month to watch how is it doing with the type of sunlight we get in this valley. How is this variety doing with the pests that we can get? What happened with that frost the other night? And so they meet and discuss all for full growing season. And then at the end of it, they'll have a meeting and a real discernment. Is this a variety we want to give a bigger try to next year? And it's been, again, a slow way, but we've found it to be really, really important. And just in this last year, we've been doing a lot of data collection and to assess the impact of our work. And from that diversity block work in Humla, there were 500 households now have 2 months more food that they can grow on their small pieces of land. They still have some shortages and have sons who go out to be a porter or earn income other ways, but they've increased by 2 months their own food supplies, and that's just been in 4 years. So we've been very, very pleased that what seems like a slow process has brought some really good and careful investments in their agricultural system. And we will be continuing working slowly with the diversity blocks in Humla on beans. And there's lots of pictures on the website and a little photo study I did about them last year. In the Middle Hills, which are warmer and you can grow food all year long, one of the biggest issues is the rivers and the power of the water during the rainy season. And so in those parts of the country, the seed work is a lot about grasses and trees and saplings along riverbanks. And again, we've just been assessing the impact of work on about 2,000 hectares of riverbanks. So it's not square hectares, it's long, skinny ones, up valleys and up tributaries, round and round in the east central part of the country. And there's about 2,000 hectares that was essentially eroded riverbank land 5 years ago. And now all 2,000 are under. They've been seeded with local seeds. The communities are watching them. They're keeping the animals from eating everything. The animals still have to graze, but they just don't graze constantly. And planting saplings, a lot of fruit trees, agroforestry along the sides. And they have calculated that 200 hectares are now producing food. So 2,000 are protected, and 10% of that is actually producing food, where none of that land was producing food before and was actually just eroded sandy riverbanks that were quite a hazard to villages and to livelihoods. So we've been very pleased with knowing how we see those results, but to be able to document it and have hard data around all of that is very important. Now, I couldn't resist tying in Timor-Leste this morning, because it's only been the last year and a half that I've been responsible for that program. We had some staff leave and one thing and another, and so now I have the whole Asia program, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Timor. And so it's a new program for me. And I've found it similar in some ways, but also very, very different and a nice new challenge. But it's the most food insecure country in Asia. Hundreds of years of colonialism, decades of violence, repression of culture and language, plantation agriculture, many reasons why Timor is not able to feed its very small population of only 500,000 people. The biggest difference is, you know, Bangladesh has 140 million people and Timor has 500,000. So it feels very different even when I'm there. But we did a survey again 5 years ago. We were doing baseline work. And in the parts of Timor where USC was beginning to work, virtually every household had a 14-week hunger season. 14 weeks. They couldn't grow enough, and so they had a gap of that long, which doesn't mean they eat zero for 14 weeks, but it means they reduce meals, they send some family members away to work, only some people eat, there's not very much protein. Like it's a very hungry season while the crops are still in the field and waiting to be harvested, and that period is November to February, so right now. And we started working with the communities and SISTO and our colleagues there, who are all Timorese, on how to work with that. Well, grow more. Well, the soil is eroded. There's very little seed. The climate is wet and warm all the time. You lose half your crop just to mold in the storage season because it's just so. It's like living in a yogurt maker. That's what it feels like. And it came from my colleagues in Nepal, who are much closer by, and they said, well, it's a little similar to some of our experiences in Nepal. What about seeing if there's some season that you could stretch with some vegetables to come to harvest during the hungry season? Are there some varieties that you could try planting off-season a bit, but with really good drainage, so in the rainy season they could get started at a different time, you know, experiment? And so we did a lot of work with trying out those varieties and also diversity blocks with longer season types of corn and taro and sweet potato. And Timor is a long way from here. It takes 2.5 full days for me to just get to the airport in Dili from Ottawa. It's the other side and then down. It's really, really far. But from Nepal, they can be there in a day and they have no jet lag. So Pratap has been visiting from Nepal to Timor, because that's what makes more sense, really. And he helped them do a really good in-depth household survey plus discussion groups last year. And 80% of the households in Timor that we've been working with have reduced the hunger season by 4 weeks. And we're expecting it'll actually be one or two more weeks. We're doing a final survey right now, just because of the adjusting varieties that will come during the hungry season, a little bit of increase in yield through some soil and water conservation practices, and some really careful seed-saving work. Because one of the hardest things with many grains, and it doesn't work with the pumpkin that I spoke of earlier, is if you're saving it for seed, you can't eat it. If you've got a bag of corn in the corner that's your seed, and you're out of food, the seed is a food supply. So you have to build up other sources of food supply to fill the hungry season while you build up the seed very slowly. But we're just really, really pleased. And we've been seeing for years, we knew the impact was being felt, but now we have very good documentation that we've reduced that hunger period already by 4 weeks and probably another two when we check in later this year. So those are just some of the threads of how seeds and season and some extraordinary people work together to address food and food security issues in a really local way. And that's what we feel very, very proud to be able to support and to be supported by people like you and by many, many farmers in Canada as well. I've put up some information and a banner, and there's more and more from USC about our Canadian work, which is now quite a large program And I met farmers yesterday at Qualicum Beach CD Saturday, seed growers who have been part of some of the research trials and the seed facilitation fund and investments to help the seed community here slowly build up and grow more good local organic seed. So it's all about seeds all the time, really, I've decided. In every season. Right now, it's CD Saturday time. And if any of you, how many people here have been, to be a little participatory, have been to a CD Saturday? How many have been to more than one? How many go to far too many CD Saturdays every year? And considering my very tiny little shady garden in Ottawa. But they're such an important part of community building and the food systems, and also supporting our farmers and the land out here. And BC absolutely leads the way in so many ways, and the rest of Canada is learning from them. So I'm really looking forward to speaking with more of you after the service, and you're welcome to contact me anytime about our international work, the national work in Canada, what it's like to work at a charitable organization today in Canada. I love talking about that too. So thank you again for the warm welcome this morning and for letting me share the very personal side of the work. Thank you.